This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Using every trick in the book, every guile that you've got in your body, you have to put to use, you know, to survive, yeah. To try and get to whatever. You lie a lot, right. to authorities, right. You know, yeah, yeah. And you go places without visas, you know, all the time. You cross borders illegally, yeah. You know, but otherwise you won't get the pictures, yeah. And the authorities, whoever they might be, can continue telling lies. So, you know, it's a great endeavor.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hello, filmmakers. It's Paul Webster back in the seat. I haven't done a podcast in a while, but I'm really excited about this one. I had a lot of fun chatting with Seamus Murphy, the director of The Curious Sensation of Being, Pat Inglesby. I initially saw a short version of this about a year ago at the Molly Museum and was really struck by it. I knew a tiny bit about Pat Inglesby, but I didn't really know anything, it turned out, and was totally endeared by the character. And then it was great to see that there was a feature film being made of the same story, and I got to see it at the IFI DocFest there a couple of weeks ago, and you will get a chance to see it being released on the 4th of November. So if you go to breakoutpictures.ie, you'll be able to find all the information about it there. I really encourage you to go see it. Had a fascinating chat with Seamus about his career as a photographer. Also, if you go to his website, Seamus Murphy Photography, if you Google that, you'll find him. He has an incredible collection of photographs going back about 40 years now, and they're incredible images. So we got to talk a lot about that, and then kind of his journey into filmmaking, making a film with PJ Harvey, Dog Called Money, which is a fantastic film. I urge you to seek that out as well. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this chat with Seamus Murphy.
I've just cleared a space on my floor. It's ready to receive 2,000 more copies of Poems So Fresh and New Yahoo. The van arrives at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. I will help the man. Together we will walk in and out to the van. He will wheel and I will carry. We will sweat. My forehead under my arms will be wet. It'll be worth it. When he's gone, I look at my new blue and white book mountain all along the wall of my sitting room and say to myself, here we go again. My poems. I write them. I publish them. I love them. They keep me alive. I sell them through the shops. I sell them in the street. My face and my arms are brown from the sun. Tonight I lie awake for a long time, excited, like Christmas Eve, a long time ago. My books are coming in the morning.
So we're in the studio here with Seamus Murphy. You're very welcome.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
You are in town from London, is that right?
Yeah, I live in London. And we had a screening last night at the Lighthouse. It was like a premiere screening. And the film goes out from November the 4th.
Brilliant. So I actually saw so kind of a shortened version of this maybe last year of the film with about Pat Inglesby at the Molly Museum.
Yeah, we did a sort of it was like a video installation from the film. Molly were very supportive. Simon O'Connor loves Pat and liked the work I did. I actually did an exhibition of Still's work that I did of a book called The Republic, and it was in the museum of the Little Museum in Dublin, and Simon was there. So we've worked together before. Anyway, they supported us in a way, and so they had this you know special edition of the film, which was great. Yeah. Because also it gave Pat that recognition that, you know, he doesn't really have and should have. So that was lovely.
Yeah. Well, I have to admit, I recognised him and I'd seen him, but I never actually really knew his work. Or I think I was burned because I went to college in Galway and there were always street poets selling their poetry on the street. And I bought a couple and they were always dreadful.
Yeah, that's the thing. And, you know, also people thought at times it's a homeless guy. I mean, and he's got a poem. Young girl explained to me, like, why I'm not selling any books. Pat, they think you're homeless, you know. And he's very, you know, he's very honest about that. Yeah. And very, very sort of, you know, funny about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I, you know, for him it was, and, you know, in the film we go into this, where, you know, he'd been in RTE for 10 years. That was a great sort of experience launch, but he wanted so much more. And I think also the fame thing really didn't sit well with him. His mental health issues, had mental health issues. Mm. And this thing just seemed to kind of really mess things up. So, you know, overnight, as he says, you know, he stopped RTE. He absolutely voluntarily left and took out a black plastic bag, put it on the street, and he had a self-published book and he started selling. And of course, people thought, it, you know, he'd fallen from grace, but actually he really found himself. That was his salvation in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's beautifully captured in the film. Just, you kind of get the sense of street life. And that was when I first saw the short and then later saw the feature, I really was struck by how it was shot. And I was like, I had to look you up. And then I realized you were a photographer, and then you have a wealth of photographs on your website. I spent an afternoon just going through, so I'd love to maybe go back to your journey into photography first, and then led to filmmaking.
Sure. I mean, I studied years ago in Rathmines College, you know, communications. It was the very early days. I think it was the second year of that course. It was very theoretical. It wasn't very practical. So when I left after 3 years, you know, I wasn't able to go into the industry as such. I mean, I think some people did, but I didn't. And I wanted to get out of Ireland. This was the 80s. It was a dreadful, grim time to be in Ireland.
Yeah.
So I went to America for a number of years and bummed around and sort of, in a way, sort of found myself in some ways. And that was where I really developed photography, because there was a public darkroom down the street from where I lived in San Francisco. And it was when I was able to sort of take a photograph during the day, process it, you know, that evening, and then print it that night. I mean, you know, that was our version of digital. Yeah. That was just amazing to see the image come through in the developer.
Yeah.
So I got completely gripped, and that was, you know, passion there. And then I came back to England to live, and I started working in the film industry, camera assistant. I was probably the world's worst camera assistant, you know. I mean, like clapper loader.
Right, yeah.
Really not technical in that way.
Yeah.
And the guys that do that are so into it, and they're so brilliant.
Yeah.
And the Brits are just, you know, as technicians, they're incredible. And I was just terrible. And I didn't like working in big groups, you know. It just felt like I was lost. I was a cog in the wheel, and it didn't suit me. And I thought, well, maybe I'll give the photography a try. So it's funny, you know, just very, very recently, in fact, during the pandemic, I started going back through archives that I hadn't scanned before. Because, you know, when you're a working photographer and traveling a lot, in the days when there were lots of assignments, you know, I'd be somewhere and I'd come back and I'd do an edit and I'd give it to a magazine. And, you know, 6-10 pictures out of 2 weeks, maybe a month's work. And there was all this other work, and I never really looked at it. Certainly didn't scan it, because it was all another process in those days.
Yeah.
So I started thinking, okay, I'll start scanning. I better go back to the very beginning. And the very beginning was San Francisco.
Right.
And I just assumed this is going to be very fast, because there isn't much here of interest, because I was learning how to take photographs. I was learning how to process film. And as I said, I'm not very technical. So a lot of the processing was terrible. But what I found was not just pictures that still sort of spoke to me, but pictures that I would take now, you know, that my, whatever I'm doing, it hasn't changed that much, which kind of stunned me. Because I think when I started to think about working as a professional, I must have chosen pictures that I thought the newspapers and magazines wanted to see, and it certainly wasn't the pictures I was choosing now when I was scanning so many years later.
Right.
And I mean, so much so that an Italian publisher is going to publish it as a book, which I really am. I'm not being modest here. I'm absolutely stunned. So anyway, that was the very beginning, and I was living in London. I came back every Christmas for as exiles do.
Yeah.
To Dublin, and my father was a GP in Finglas, and I was sitting in his car. He was doing a house call, and these kids went by on horseback, you know, bareback horseback, in the middle of Finglas. And I looked and I said, that's a familiar sight to me, but I've been away now a number of years. That is not normal. So I started looking into it. Of course, there was the market in Smithfield, and I shot a story on that and some of the kids in Finglas, and they kept horses in their back gardens. It's an old story now, but I think I was one of the first to do it.
Right.
And the Independent in London ran it as a huge feature.
Okay.
And I got picked up by a Swedish newspaper and became a photographer for them in London, you know, and that was the beginning of you know, my career.
Right. Yeah. Do you remember what your first, say, assignment or your first, like, one that you were really excited about?
I'd say my first assignment, paid assignment, was not a very exciting job. It was for the Times Literary Supplement, and it was some school in Brent Council, and it was boring. But you know, I was being paid for it to take a picture. Yeah. Jesus Christ, that was incredible.
Yeah.
First assignment, it was probably, it was the Swedish one where I was sent back with a journalist for the first time to shoot in colour what I'd shot in black and white, you know, Smithfield and Finglas and Ballymun, you know, and the whole thing. That was amazing. And I was working with a Swedish journalist, and I was working for the Swedish press, and I discovered that they paid very, very well, much more than Fleet Street.
Right.
And they were just very cool to deal with. And they were so ahead of the game in terms of technology. Now, we're not talking here about, we're talking about film,
but
you know, they gave me a scanner, which was a Hasselblad thing. I think it was worth $100,000 or something. I mean, really expensive. And I'd be sent to Manchester, say, to shoot a football match, and I'd have to process the color film in the hotel bathroom, and then scan it on this beast of a machine that had no memory. So you'd scan the picture, and then you'd send it, and then you'd scan another one, and the picture would be, I mean, it would be saved on the other end. But you had to do things like unpick the telephone line to connect it as a modem. I mean, it was very, very old technology now, but in terms of Britain, it was way ahead of Britain.
Right, okay.
You know, so that was all really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but you know, sort of starting out as a photographer, or, you know, with ideas and being creative, you know, you sort of, you use that somewhat in your professional life, but you really have to put it away because, you know, they're the needs of the paper. You've got to make a living, and you start thinking a different way. And that's why coming back to that stuff in San Francisco was like, oh my God, you know, it's taken me, you know, so many years to realize that what I moved away from professionally and started doing my own personal work, I was doing that right from the start.
Right,
that was the sort of natural way that I wanted to shoot.
Yeah.
But I'd curbed it to make a living and to fit in.
Yeah. And was there anyone whose work inspired you at that time, or were you kind of just figuring it out
yourself? Yeah, no, there was. I mean, the thing about San Francisco was it was an amazing time to be there. It was the 80s. And I was buying all these photo books from garage sales, you know, yard sales. And so I'd be picking up very eclectic mix of work. William Klein was a big influence. Cartier-Bresson, obviously, was like, you know, probably the first, you know, first time I saw that picture. I think it's Morocco, of a fat man walking sort of from right to left. And there's this wall behind him. Or maybe it's Spain. Wall behind him with pockmarks on it, and there's kids in the forefront. I mean, it's just unbelievable,
right?
You know, I mean, the whole world is there, and just seeing that was like beautiful and terrifying. You know?
Yeah.
Who else? I mean, yeah. As I say, I mean, I was sort of open to all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there was that topographical movement. What's his name? He died not that long ago. I actually met him. Wonderful photographer, but the kind of stuff that I would never probably take myself, but I could really appreciate it. It was things like, you know, garage doors and walls, environment, you know, urban environment.
Yeah.
And I think it's crept into my own work
Yeah.
in its own way.
And you would have found yourself in fairly dire situations. So you were in Ethiopia and places like that. How Ethiopia, did you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, all over. That was an interesting one. I just recently came across, you know, a folder of stuff, and I started again looking at it. I've been scanning that work, because I think on my website there's an Ethiopian section, but it's actually a very limited amount of pictures. I just scanned 150 pictures, you know, from that trip.
Right.
And that trip was actually, that was a sort of typical case in point. I was with an agent in New York, really good agent called Marcel Saba, and he had a Saba Press Photo was the name of the agency. It was in the days when agencies were still sort of viable.
Right.
And there was bad things brewing in Ethiopia, and he rang me up and said, listen, do you want to go to Ethiopia? We think there's a famine going on. And in those days, what would happen is you'd with an agent like that, they'd pay 50% of the expenses and you'd pay 50% of the expenses. You may not pay for it. You know, it might just come out of your take.
Right.
But you'd go. I was on a plane that night, you know, right. And it was film and shooting black and white. And it was, you know, it was a famine. I saw lots of death, and it was terrible because people were being fed because they were in one tribe and not another.
Right.
You know, so the aid was going, you know, it was very controlled, and there was a drought, but also there was war, but it was very politically driven. And in Ethiopia was fighting a war with Eritrea over like a hill of sand, and yet they were spending $1 million a day, and yet their people were starving.
Yeah.
And it was more political than that, because it was an area that was actually a Somali area of Ethiopia called Ogaden, the Ogaden region. Anyway, I went to that. I'd never been to a famine before, it was really shocking. And it's interesting too, because I was recalling that it was before digital, before, you know, and Time magazine were interested, very interested. And I had this bag of film. And I also had very bad diarrhea because I'd been in this really terrible famine situation, and I was absolutely fine all the way through that, you know. And then I came back to Addis to fly out the next day, and I was in a really expensive hotel, and I ate food there, and that's what gave me food poisoning.
Right.
And I got back to London, and I couldn't leave the flat, but Time magazine needed the pictures. I had to go to Heathrow to catch the Concorde to get the film on the plane by 9 a.m. And I spent the whole night on the loo trying to sort of make it so I could go to drive out to Heathrow. Anyway, in the end, I just shit, you know, I put on three pairs of trousers, a very heavy coat, got in the car. It was fine. Nothing happened. Yeah, but I was prepared for the worst.
Right.
And I plonked the film on the thing, and it ran in Time magazine. And that was how it was done those days.
Right.
You know? Incredible.
Yeah.
And it's not that long ago. I think it was it was 2000. It was 22 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, but that was, I wouldn't say it was typical, but you know, you could say that was that was the way business was done.
Yeah. Yeah. And did that lead to more work like that? Then
because the thing about America is, and you know, you really have to credit them. You know, you do something in America, and it's recognized and it's remembered. You know, it's incredible. I did a story that same year. It was a very busy year for me. I was in Afghanistan, and I did a story up in the north about Massoud, who is this amazing Mujahideen commander who had fought the Russians, and you know, the Russians could never conquer him, and he ended up being assassinated. It was terrible, but you know, I spent time with him, and he was the last guy, you know, the last man standing was the title of the piece, which ran in the New York Times magazine. It's about this guy fighting the Taliban, and the rest of the world weren't listening, and he actually made a prediction that there was a big thing about to happen in the West. You know, his intelligence was hearing that there was a big thing planned in 9/11.
Yeah.
They killed him 2 days before 9/11.
Okay.
Anyway, so that was a big story in the New York Times magazine. I still get people telling me in America they remember seeing it. So it's amazing. Yeah. Whereas in England, you know,
right.
You know, England has a very great tradition of newspapers.
Yeah.
There are magazines. There was a while, I think, in the 60s and 70s, Sunday Times, The Observer, you know, they were strong, but they've very much been a lifestyle thing.
Yeah.
You know. Whereas America, there's still a serious journalism, photojournalism, you know.
And you managed to get, you seem like, just by looking through your work, you get into places where I hadn't seen pictures of, like yours, of the tunnels. How did that come about?
I mean, that's the job, you know. That's I mean, that's what I love about it. And I haven't been doing photojournalism for a little bit now. I mean, I really want to get back to it because it's using every trick in the book, every guile that you've got in your body, you have to put to use, you know, to survive, to try and get to whatever. You lie a lot. To authorities,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
And you know, you go places without visas, you know, all the time. You cross borders illegally, you know. But otherwise, you just won't get the pictures, and the authorities, whoever they might be, can continue telling lies. So you know, it's a great endeavor.
Yeah.
But the tunnels is very interesting. It was a good friend of mine, Marie Colvin, who was killed in Syria.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Sunday Times. We'd worked together in Kosovo and. She was an old hand of the Middle East, especially Palestine, Israel.
Yeah.
She was based in Jerusalem for years.
Right.
Knew it very well. And you know, we'd all heard about these tunnels, but we always thought it was just Israeli propaganda.
Yeah.
And then she came across this guy in Gaza who said, "Oh yeah, well the family, you know, we're in the family business, the tunnel business." And she said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, we're in the business, you know, it's so it suddenly dawned on her, like, there really are tunnels, and we're going to find them."
Yeah,
and so we did, and it was pretty extraordinary. Yeah,
yeah,
pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, so just the work of it, and
incredible. And then we were talking to these people that, you know, they swore they weren't involved. You know, Egyptians actually, because you know the tunnels were going to Egypt, and absolutely swore. And you know, we spent, you know, a week with them and the family. And. And then we left, and a week later, they were caught doing the tunneling. They were doing it themselves, you know. Right. It was just incredible.
Yeah.
The subterfuge that was going on.
Yeah.
But it was incredible, you know, to be forced into that position that you had to tunnel under the ground.
Yeah.
Just to get supplies in and you know, keep alive.
And that of, like, from what I hear of all places, you know, for journalists to deal with Israelis is very difficult, right?
It's very hard. I mean, I actually worked on a film. I was a stills photographer on a film called Paradise Now, which was made in 2004, I think it was. And I'd never actually been, at that stage, I'd never been to Palestine, Israel. And I was brought in as a stills photographer because they were shooting in Nablus. They were shooting a feature film in Nablus. It was a Palestinian film. Well, Palestinian, Israeli, Dutch, German sort of co-production, and we had to lie to the Israelis to say, "Oh, we're working on a romance film," and you know, it was actually about two suicide bombers.
Right.
And Nablus, they chose Nablus because Nablus was the epicenter of where the suicide bombers were launched from. So we got amazing access to the old city. I was able to wander around there, but they wanted a photographer who not only would shoot production stills but would also shoot what was going on in Nablus. Why we were making the film, because that was kind of part of the whole story. So I'd be on the set shooting a scene, and then I'd hear clashes downtown, and I'd say to the director, "Listen, I've got to go." They go, "Well, one more take." So I'd do one more take, and then I'd arrive at a clash in the center of the town, and you know, the Israeli IDF would be on one side, and the guys throwing stones would be the other side, and I'd be in the middle, a very dangerous place to be. Because you're better off being on one or the other. You're either with the Israelis, or if you're with the Palestinians, there's a protection of sorts. But if you're in the middle, or if you're arriving late to the party, it's very dangerous. And I was arriving late too many times. But it's on my site. It's called Paradise, if you look at it.
Yeah.
And what I did was I put together an edit of pictures that mixes the making of the film with the real thing that's happening on the streets of Nablus. And at times, you really don't know which is which. And in fact, the more interesting pictures are the real stuff, not the movie pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So you'd kind of been film adjacent, but when did you kind of get the desire to actually work as a filmmaker then?
Well, in Rathmines, you know, it was always in my head, I would love to work in films but this thing of being in a crew and being a technician didn't really work for me. And then of course, also when I got to England, it was 87, huge union. You know, it was very difficult to get into the union. I mean, I was getting into the union, but it was going to take 10 years before I could be, you know, start being a DP or maybe even being a focus puller. I mean, it takes so long.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. I mean, you know, the craft is there. And, you know, I recently worked on a film with an Irish DP, Kate McCulloch.
Yeah.
I was like second camera. They wanted the documentary approach to this film called The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. It's coming out soon, I think.
Okay.
And that was amazing. But what was amazing was that the technicians were still going through the same. I had a fantastic assistant, and she was taking a long time to go up to focus because, you know, actually no, sorry, yes, she, to, from sort of first assistant to second assistant to first assistant. So it's still there.
Yeah,
you know that process. Yeah. But I always had an inkling to make films. I've always been a huge cinephile and, you know, loved movies. And it was really the 5D, the Canon 5D, you know, because I was in Afghanistan in 2010 shooting video on that Canon that was going to be sort of B-roll for a film that I was making with an American production company about my archive in Afghanistan. So it was going to be black and white pictures, still pictures, and then this other stuff that I shot on the 5D, interviews and stuff, you know, around and you know, things that were related to the pictures, but also what was happening in Afghanistan at the time. And PJ Harvey had been in touch with me. Polly had been in touch with me. She'd seen my Afghan work and wanted to meet because she was beginning to do research and write songs. Let England Shake was the album.
Yeah.
And she wanted someone who'd been to these places. And we got talking and we got friendly. And I just come back from this filming. She said, oh, you're filming. Do you want to make some music films? And I said, yeah.
Right.
And that was it. That was what started it. That was sort of, so because I think I was having such a great time taking still pictures and I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to be a filmmaker, but this was, you know, this was really happening and, you know, I was traveling and, you know, it was great.
Yeah.
So it was a question of time. But, you know, when you're offered something and it's solid and it's new, you know, it was very new and it was very challenging.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I came up with this idea. I travel around England because my original idea was actually, okay, Let England Shake, it's about war, it's about First World War. I'll go to Iraq, you know, because I've been to Iraq a number of times. I'll go back to Afghanistan and I'll shoot stuff there.
Yeah.
And I'll make music films, you know, using my experience in those places and my contacts. But then I thought, actually, the film is really about England. And so I'll travel around England and I'll find those things, those memories, those the legacy of the empire and the wars in England.
Yeah.
So I was able to do things like Wootton Bassett, where, you know, the dead soldiers from Afghanistan were given a send-off. That's in the film.
Yeah.
You know, these things. Yeah. Places that just reminded me of First World War, Cambridge. I just found it. I found it, you know, on a very, very bleak time of year. I traveled around England.
Right.
So that's how that started. That's how the film thing started.
Yeah, yeah. Because I loved that album when it came out. And yeah, it's about England, but it's also about, it's very colonial. And, you know, there's all these sounds. It's, you know, Afghanistan and it's the reach of the empire and all that stuff. It's such an immersive album. And then with the film, I felt that kind of same. Like, you're moving around and you're kind of, there's a lovely kind of pace to it. What were your kind of instincts when it came to editing? Because
this is A Dog Called Money. Eventually. Because what happened was that was Let England Shake.
Yeah.
And then Dog Called Money was the next album, which was the Hope Six Demolition Project. Because what happened was I did the short films and it ended up, I did a film for each track. Because I shot so much stuff I was having such fun. And I met this editor who really clicked.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just great. And it went well. And, we worked really well together. And we thought, let's travel. Let's do some traveling together.
Yeah.
And rather than her just handing me the songs, let's try and be in the same place at the same time when it's all happening, when I'm filming and she's actually writing.
Yeah.
So that was the idea behind. And it's amazing. I mean, we were saying, what would be great would be, You make an album. We do a book together of your poetry and my pictures.
Yeah.
And then we'll make a film.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do that. I mean, we actually did.
Yeah.
We did. The book came out, the album came out, and the film came out.
Yeah.
Incredible. But the that evolved, you know, like everything. It was like, I was just thinking of the Pat film when I was walking here.
Yeah.
You know, I had some mad ideas. Like, this is Pat Inglesby, so really it should be something so imaginative. I mean, that was a big challenge for me too, you know.
Yeah.
Would I live up to his... you know, incredibly high bar of, you know, excellence and madness, you know, imagination, creativity. Yeah. And I had this idea at one stage, I'd turn him into a sniper. And he, you know, he goes into this attic and, you know, it's all very kind of dusty and he opens up a sort of a skylight, you know, it's a creak of the skylight. And he takes up a gun and it's like, it's a spud gun, you know, somehow.
Yeah.
And in the distance you hear a busker singing Alleluia, right? So he's going to basically kill the busker who's singing Alleluia. That was my idea. And I had it all.
Yeah.
Anyway, I never did it because the film evolved in another way. Yeah. But I had some amazing sort of thoughts about, you know, how to...
Yeah.
How, you know, he's going to murder people. And, it, you know, this is not the Paddingtons you know and love. You know, idea.
Yeah.
So anyway, these things evolve. And it's the same with A Dog Called Money. I had, you know, extraordinary thoughts about... I was even going to start using drones when drones were not being used that much.
Yeah.
I was going to have a drone following Polly and, you know, she's going to pull the curtains of the window and there's a bloody camera outside. And I was going to do all this stuff. Anyway, in the end, it didn't work out that way.
Right, yeah.
I think the material tells you, you know, what it should be.
Yeah.
And there's a logic to it from that.
Yeah.
And then sometimes some ideas creep in, like the bit where there's a choir in D.C. and they're singing the chorus of her song.
Yeah.
And then it goes to the band singing that chorus. So it's like the band are in the church, but they're not in the church.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that was a thought that I had that, you know, to mix that thing of...
Yeah.
Because it was the idea with these two different worlds, you know, the real world and the recording world and the world inside the studio and the world outside the studio.
Yeah.
The world you live in, the world the rest of the world lives in.
Yeah.
You know, that thing of looking and, you know, looking and being observed... Lots of different things going on.
Yeah. Feels like just a real collaboration. You kind of get that sense that you both just get on and you kind of click creatively.
Yeah, we do. But the funny thing is, I mean, a bit like Pat, she had no involvement in the film.
Right.
I mean, zero. Didn't see the film. Like Pat, didn't see the film until it was finished. Didn't see anything. I mean, she did see some footage because the three music films I did were material from the three places for the three songs that were released. So she did see that.
Right.
But she didn't know what I was up to.
Right.
You know.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Total creative freedom.
Yeah.
And with Pat, it was similar, but I made sure that I stopped telling him my ideas because he was very disparaging
at
times. Like, that's stupid or that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Then he'd ring up later and apologize and say, listen, I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know why I said that. I think he was having to let go of control.
Yeah.
And that was hard for him. And eventually... He let go so far that he allowed me to interview him because at the beginning, the deal was, you know, let's make a film, but I'm not being interviewed, I'm not going to be in the film,
right?
And I said, okay, we'll work around that one,
right?
And I spent probably about a year planning and shooting in a way that he was not going to appear. We're going to hear his voice. We're going to hear his poetry.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Yeah.
The rest would be filled in by me, and I would find a way to tell the story. But it was very handy to have him interviewed to sustain a, you know... Because with Polly, it's the same thing. She wouldn't be interviewed.
Right.
And I wouldn't have felt really right interviewing her because it would have felt... I don't know, it wouldn't have felt right. So right up till the end, I was trying to find a way to... You know, the film was in place, and it was going to be about these three places and the making of the album. That was all very clear. But I needed some kind of connecting thread, and I had the idea of these notebooks.
Yes.
And she gave me the notebooks, and I spent like a week looking through them, editing them down to what I thought would work for the different places. And then we agreed, yes, that's great. And then we booked a studio, did the voiceover, and then that was the thread. Because the great thing about her notebooks were that they were the first draft of, you know, we were literally, what we'd said, we go somewhere, I'm filming, and she's literally writing down what she's seeing. Now, later, she might use that material or might not use that material, and it would become a song or a poem.
Yeah.
But that was really the first draft.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very strong.
Yeah, it was lovely to see, and, you know, someone I've admired her work for so long, and just to see... that process in a very kind of just natural way, you know. She just seems to exude creativity and art.
She does.
Yeah.
She does. She does. She's always at it.
Right. Yeah.
Always at it. I mean, you know, up in the morning learning a new instrument. I mean, it just never stops. Amazing. Yeah.
She's like a kind of like of a different era, nearly.
Well, she's sort of timeless, isn't she? Yeah. And the music is timeless. Like Letting Them Shake is.
Yeah.
You know, it could be almost like sort of swing at times. You know, it's wonderful. And Hope Six, you know, that process of them making that album, it's one of the most interesting experiences of my life, I think, having witnessed that. It was there every day for whatever it was, six weeks. Incredible. The discussions about, what was working. Flood, the producer, amazing.
Right.
Funny and just brilliant. And John Parrish, all of them. I mean, just all contributing, collaborating. But she was the boss.
Right.
You know, in a very, very benign way.
Yeah.
And what they would do to make sounds, you know, like, you know, panting. At one stage, they were panting, you know, in syncopated.
Yeah,
don't know who came up with that idea. I don't think they used it in the end, but it's a fantastic experience.
Yeah, and musicians at the top of their game.
Yeah, yeah, and fearless, you know, and fearless in that, you know, they did it in front of an audience.
Yeah,
you know, and they had no idea how that was going to go. You know, it could have been a disaster.
Yeah,
but you know, they'd booked in and people had bought tickets, and you know, it was going to happen. So, you know, that was very, very, very a very public demonstration of the process.
Yeah, yeah. I'd never seen anything like that for anyone who hasn't seen the film. Essentially, they set up a studio where the musicians can't see out, but there's basically windows around and people came to see the recording process. I'd never seen.
And the great thing
like
for me as the filmmaker was, and I was the only one allowed in because, you know, and in fact, it was even sort of put to a vote. Not the musicians, they were happy with me, but...
yeah.
The management at Somerset House, where it was done, you know, they had to agree that the public were not going to be put off by me walking around with a camera, and so they said, "Okay, let's do one session, and we'll watch, and we'll tell you." And they forgot I was there because I just blended in, and I was me with my bloody Canon 5D. It was you know, I had three cameras on the go at times on different tripods. It was really crazy. Every day I would just come back exhausted,
right?
But it was amazing, and.
And is it just you, or do you have a sound person? Or
no, I had an assistant, Max. My nephew was downloading stuff I was shooting.
Yeah.
The sound was fantastic because I had, you know, microphones on my cameras. But in order for the public to be able to hear what all the discussions that was going on, everyone wore a radio mic,
right.
And I had all that material,
right.
Which was, you know, again, my editor is a sort of genius at organization.
Right.
We had this unbelievable. Every night I had to spend, after like finishing up and being exhausted, I'd wait an hour and a half to download everything, back it up before I left, you know, the studio. So I'd leave at 9 o'clock at night.
Okay.
It was amazing.
Award-winning Spice Bags podcast is back with season 4. You can expect the same mix of staple chats with me, Dee Laffin,
Blanca Valencia,
and Mae Chin,
and deep dives into country's cuisines, conversations with people from the international community of food in Ireland. Look forward to listening to episodes about shopping, about cakes, Argentina, Nigeria, plus an episode to celebrate the launch of our cookbook, Blasta Books Soup. So tune in to us wherever you access your podcasts or headstuffpodcast.com.
Just going to take a little break there, a little bit of F&I news. There's going to be a Christmas party on the 10th of December in Northern Seoul, just there at Grattan Bridge at the end of Capel Street. We urge you to come along, bring friends, celebrate a year and getting back to socialising again and kind of normality that has returned to filmmaking. It should be a good night. So if you want to check the socials for information there, or go to wearefni.com.
How did you find me? How in the name of God did you find me? A tiny infant down in the heart of old Malahide village, in the little house beside the coal yard. Were you looking for me or what? Jesus, I was only just born. I knew nothing at all. The name they put on you was bigger than me. Infantile paralysis. And you found me down there in that beautiful place, beside the village green, looking over to the island, looking out to sea. You came into me and you made me cry. What time did you come in? What day was it? Because I don't know. And what brought you down that way in 1942? Which way did you come? Was it down New Street, past Bertie Boyle's? Was the tide full in? I don't know that either. Did I make a sound as you were going past? Was that the way it happened? Was the wireless on? What could you hear? Are you still alive? Are you still doing your virus stuff? I'd like to know your name. Mine is Pat. I played soccer in spite of you, and I was good.
Yeah, I get the sense that that film took a while, like, you know.
It took a while. COVID happened. Funding was tricky, especially with, you know, this is a film about Paddington's Beauty, he won't be appearing in it. I don't think that was a big issue, actually. I think it was also an issue of selling Pat.
Yeah.
You know, because you know, the arts establishment, they, you know, we got shortlisted for Arts Council film grant.
But seems an absolute natural.
Absolutely.
Fit. Yeah.
But they didn't go for it. And I, you know, from the questioning, it was like, well, why him, you know?
Mm.
And I felt like saying, well, if you have to ask that question, then we're wasting our time here, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that was probably the thing that was difficult. So I played up the, which is very true, and it's still true in the film. This is a film not equally about Dublin, but Dublin is very, very much one of the characters.
Yeah,
you know, a main character. So I was pushing that side of it, and so yeah, it did take time. It took time, so, you know, it took long enough that the trust was built up and then he would agree to be interviewed and let go of some control.
Yeah.
The editing took time.
Right.
You see, it started in 2013. I made a short film for The New Yorker about Dublin. It was an idea that, you know, when I was three, 1963, John F. Kennedy came to Ireland and I saw him. Went along with my father and I saw this guy and I remember it. I mean, it must be my first memory because I can't remember much else until I was about 12.
Right.
But I remember JFK and his ginger hair. I remember that.
Right.
And that was, you know, hugely interesting. And then, you know, later that year, I remember my mother crying because Kennedy was killed.
Right.
So that was quite an introduction to America.
Yeah.
So I pitched this idea. Look, I do a story about being from Dublin but returning to Dublin, having travelled around and being around the world, but it's also the 50th anniversary of his death. And they went, yeah, that sounds like an interesting idea. And that was the beginning of this film, and I started shooting, and there was a JFK thing in New Ross, because that was where the family came from, so I went along to that and shot footage of that, and, you know, there were sort of images of JFK in shot windows. It was an interesting mix of stuff. But at the end of it, this was even the time when the AIB, was it AIB? No. The tapes of those bankers that had, do you remember?
Anglo-Irish.
Yeah, they picked a number out of their arse. That stuff was going on. And I recorded all that and I was going to use that in the film. And, you know, again, ideas evolve. And I had it all down. I went to New York and showed it to the New Yorker and they loved it. They loved it. They were very happy, but I wasn't actually happy. And I thought, there's something missing here. You know, there's something missing that I'm not getting this right. It was only a 10-minute film, but I really wanted it to, 12-minute film. I really wanted it to work.
Yeah.
And I thought, Pat Inglesby is, now that's a persona. I didn't know Pat. I didn't really know his poetry that much, but I do remember him being a very interesting character.
Yeah.
And I was aware that he was still around. And I thought, this might be an interesting connection with the past and the 60s. And so anyway, I met him.
Yeah.
And we got on really well.
Yeah.
And, you know, within 10 minutes, we were in the Palace Bar. He was drinking coffee. I was drinking a pint and I started going through his book, and with a sound recorder in my hand, I recorded some poems and they ended up in the film. In fact, some of them are even in this film.
Okay. Yeah.
So in 2013, I shot a lot of footage around Dublin. And of course, a lot of it didn't end up in that film. And I ended up using some of that in this film. So actually some of the footage is from 2013.
Okay.
It was a really nice summer and, so it took time.
Yeah. And because some of the most memorable moments are just Pat lying around in his house. So it took you a while to get there, obviously.
Well, no, that was fairly early on, because what happened was, okay, he's not going to be in the film,
right?
But his voice is. So okay. I thought, okay, this is going to take time. There's a lot of poems and I wanted to be relaxed. So I'll set up a thing in his home where he's wearing a mic and I'm giving him all these poems to recite and he'll recite them. That was the plan. And after the first day and listening to like 100 anecdotes in between each poem, and then him saying, oh, hang on, this is a great poem.
Yeah.
One I hadn't chosen. And they were all great poems.
Yeah.
I realized I'm not going to miss this. So I brought in the camera very visibly and he could see I was setting the camera up.
Yeah.
As long as I didn't ask him a question, he was fine.
Okay.
And if I did ask him a question, there'd be a frosty silence. And like, I'm not doing a fucking interview, you know.
Right.
So, oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I kept filming. And so that was, you know, Vagina in the Vatican, for example.
Yeah.
You know, the full glory of that is him lying against a beanbag in his house.
Yeah.
You know, one take. And look at that. I mean, when you listen to it, the delivery is perfect.
Yeah.
And that was very early on.
Yeah.
You know, very early on.
Yeah. And what do you feel his resistance to being interviewed initially? Where was that coming from, do you think?
I think he doesn't like talking about himself.
Okay.
He doesn't like the spotlight, weirdly enough. I mean, you know, like everyone, he's a complicated character.
Yeah.
You know, he loves attention. He found himself, you know, when he picked up a microphone at Red Island Holiday Camp and started entertaining people, he discovered who he was.
Right.
And yet, being so authentic to himself and having mental health issues and discovering that actually this was not healthy for him, that's why he left RTE. You know, I think doing an interview would be all the things he hated about fame and celebrities, you know, going on the Late Late Show and complaining about being famous. And his thing is, well, then just don't go on the Late Late Show.
Or,
you know, you don't have to, we don't have to hear about you complaining about it.
Yeah.
And all you're doing is publicizing yourself and brushing your own ego. He hates that.
Right.
And I hate that too. So it was a real meeting of minds. And so that, I think that was it. I think that it was the fact that, you know, I'll be talking about myself and that's awful. And I, you know, and he also was aware that because he's such a great performer, he'll end up performing. But, that, you know, it was unavoidable. I think also, as time went on, he could see Tom Burke was the producer, who's himself a great director, you know, but he sacrificed himself at the altar of Pat Inglesby to get this film made, and I couldn't have made it without him, you know.
Right.
And, you know, it was a collaboration. You know, I think Pat saw the work we were putting into it, and he trusted us.
Right.
And, you know, that I think that's what it was. I think it was the building up of trust.
Yeah.
And he felt that he could let go and he would be in safe hands. He wouldn't be exploited. He himself could control the situation in an interview, which he did.
Yeah.
He certainly did.
Right.
He talked about what he wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
He wasn't cornered in any way. I didn't sort of try to catch him out or delve into things that would be, you know, interesting and fruity. You know what I mean? Didn't do any of that. I just wanted to hear him tell his story.
Yeah.
You know.
One of the things I loved about it was how you shot Dublin. It's kind of an ode to Dublin. It connected with me because I spent a year making a documentary and series about Dublin Bay. So I kind of thought I'd shot the whole, everything, you know. But watching your film, I was like, I love the way, you captured it in a really interesting way, Malahide and Clontarf. And you kind of captured a kind of a surrealness as well. How much of that was kind of planned and how much was just kind of like just going out and shooting?
It was just going out and shooting in the way that I like to shoot. You know, I think it was certainly my intention and my desire to have a film which was featuring Pat Inglesby and his poetry, that would in some way, you know, be consistent with that. But that's the way I shoot. I mean, that's the thing. It's like that short film. I'd shot all of that before I met Pat.
Right.
And then I put together sequences using his poetry. I didn't have to go out and shoot anything extra. It was all there because it's kind of the way I shoot.
Right.
So it's just me, I guess it's my eye, my approach.
Yeah.
And And I am an insider, outsider insider. You know, I'm from Dublin, grew up in Dublin, and at the age of whatever, 23, I left, and I never lived here since, but I visit a lot. So I am an outsider, but I'm still very familiar with Dublin, and I know how it's represented, and so, you know, there's things that I don't. I mean, you know, the Pigeon House is, it's such a landmark. And in some ways, you can't avoid it. You know, if you're shooting landscapes, it's always there, or, you know, in some way.
Yeah.
Touchstones, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that wonderful poem, The Man Who Calls Everyone John, and it's the guy walking along reading his newspaper, and he stops every so often, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I shot that without that poem in mind, but it, you know, looking through, and I love the poem, looking through, oh, this might work.
Yeah.
You know, because it stops and starts and stops, and this guy could be John, you know.
Yeah.
You could just imagine him being John, you know, on his day off or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the very end, he walks along, and there's the pigeon house, and it wasn't intended.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, thank you. That's lovely to hear.
What's next for you, or do you?
Yeah, I'm doing a number of things. There's a project that I've shot as a stills project. It's done, America, Russia. Their odd relationship, their odd sort of romance almost.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, I've been working on that for years. Everything takes years.
Yeah.
I started doing the project as an American project, and then I went to Russia on an assignment, and I'd been to Russia before, but because I think the American work was in my head, it was like, hang on a minute, this is very similar. This is actually, you know, people's lives are not that different.
Yeah.
Ordinary people in America, ordinary people in Russia.
Yeah.
You know, so that led to a thought that maybe I could do a project that sort of looked not at the huge contrast, but actually where we, you know, could mistake one place for another. And the edit I've done is America, Russia, you know, you know which is which as you're going through it, but then you lose track.
Right.
And I've done this with Americans and Russians, and they get it wrong. So it's kind of interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't shoot it deliberately that way.
Yeah.
So I've done that, and I'm making a moving image version of that. It's loosely based on the same kind of conceit.
Yeah.
But obviously being a film, it'll be different, and there's people talking, and there's the Afghan war. Afghanistan is in there because it's a common war that the two countries have shared.
Yeah.
And I did a short film for Channel 4 News on Russian, Soviet, Afghan veterans, you know, who fought that war, still alive.
Right.
Because we always hear about the Americans, but we never really hear that about it. So that was very interesting. So I'm using them against the Americans.
Yeah.
And there are different versions of what they think of the country.
Yeah.
What they think they, you know, did right, what they got wrong. Very interesting. The Russians, they've all now come to the conclusion, helped and bent by Putin, that, you know, Gorbachev apologized for the Afghan war and said it was a huge mistake.
Yeah.
Putin has turned it all around and says, we were absolutely right. This was the right thing to do. And all the veterans, of course, are very happy about that because they feel like it wasn't in vain.
Oh, okay.
So they've bent the narrative to suit, they've bent reality to suit their narrative,
right,
which is very indicative of how Putin runs his country.
Yeah.
So that's involved in the film. So it's a different, but it's kind of a similar idea, general idea. So I'm working on that. There's a family that I met in my first trip to Afghanistan in '94. I stayed with them very briefly, but got to know them. And every time I went to Afghanistan, I would check in with them and take a few portraits and,
yeah,
you know, find out what was going on. And they've lost lots of people.
Yeah.
One is now living in another country. One is still there trying to get out. So I've been photographing them, and I'm looking at the possibility of making a film around that.
Okay.
There's a few things that have to be done before I can do that.
Yeah.
But I was back there earlier in the year during the summer, and I learned all kinds of new things about the family that had been sort of kept from me and from everyone else.
Yeah.
That just opened up their story.
Yeah.
And you realize, I mean, when I met them first, it was 1994, a terrible civil war. They were in a desperate situation, living in one of the most dangerous parts of Kabul. And they were living on a front line. And one of them had lost a leg the year before in a rocket attack on the street. They'd lost a boy, a young man, to the fighting a few years before that. When I went to see them again 2 years later, the Taliban had taken over Kabul, and two of them had been killed. So the guys I'd photographed, I did a family picture again, and there were two missing. They were been killed. And it goes on, and then they get married. The younger ones get married. I met the younger one. The youngest one was 12 when I met him. Now he's 41. And he's got four kids.
Right.
And he's still there. His older brother was 15 when I met him. He had one leg. He's now living somewhere else. So there's a very interesting story. It's a story of a family at war.
Yeah.
And if I can find a way to make a film of that using my stills as well, and the stills I have generally of Afghanistan, I'd like to put that together.
How do you kind of process your life in that way, in that you're going to these quite extreme places, and when you come back to London, how does it affect you? Like,
I think the camera protects you. You know, you're not going just to experience all this misery. Because also the thing is, you know, you focus on the story and you focus on the people and their situation. And it might be terrible. It might be, you know, war-stricken. But a lot more goes on. There's a lot more joy to it.
Yeah.
And I try and incorporate that in my work. You know, that I did a book on Afghanistan, Darkness Visible, and I remember someone saying, why is everyone laughing all the time? And I think there's six pictures of people laughing. But, you know, out of 100 pictures, six is nothing because, you know, they're laughing a lot. You know, people laugh a lot.
Yeah.
And so, you know, life is fuller than just the misery. And so it's not all doom and gloom when I'm there. It is, you have to adjust. But I think you are protected by the camera.
Mm.
You know, you have a mission. You have a task. You're busy sort of making sure you do certain things. You got to catch a flight. You got to get the visa. You got to stay alive. That's all very engaging.
Yeah.
I think later on things do hit you, you know, or sometimes, you know, when you're scanning a picture you haven't seen for a while and you look again and, oh, Jesus, yeah, that is a dead body. And, you know, they are lived experiences.
Yeah.
I don't get nightmares over it, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there may be things that have affected me that I'm not aware of.
Right.
That's absolutely possible. And PTSD works in strange ways.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure I have PTSD of some kind, but I think everyone does.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
You know, a car accident or your parents separating, whatever it might be, you know.
Yeah.
We all have these things. We deal with it. That's life.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Kind of leads nicely. We always kind of ask a question towards the end. We're very much a podcast that's aimed at creative people getting into the industry and that kind of thing. And we all love it, but it can be tough as well. You face rejection, you face
nightmare
periods where you're not working, and then sometimes when
it's
too
a daily
much work.
Struggle,
right? Yeah,
you reinvent the wheel every time you wake up,
right?
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. I mean, photography has gone, you know, as you know, it's you know, went from being a career and a job and a profession that, you know, there was so much work, so many people employed. I mean, for example, you know, when I went to Concord, you know, the film was processed. I mean, I brought the film and put it on the plane. People processed that film. There were labs doing that, you know, running 24 hours a day. There were couriers that took that to the agency. There were people in the agency going through the pictures, you know, editing them, captioning them, you know. All those people were employed. They're not there. I go with a bloody camera now, and I'm expected to, you know, process the image, send it, do all the captioning.
Yeah.
You know, so how many people have lost a job right there? Then you've got, you know, the magazines themselves. You know, I'm not going to bitch about this because there's no point. But, you know, it's very tough.
Right.
It is very tough. The film game, I'm sort of getting to know.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be a lot easier than photography. I don't think it is at all.
Not really, yeah.
You know, we still work for very little money and we put together these films, and the budget's always, you know, minuscule. And maybe it'll change in time. I don't know. It's tough. It's tough. I ain't gonna lie.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You have to do commercial stuff. You have to do stuff that you don't necessarily want to do. But you know, we do it because we want to do it. So I'm not going to bitch.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful way to spend your life.
Yeah. It's a way I think of it, and definitely your work. It's an adventure.
It is. It is. It has to be. And, you know, when it stops being interesting on that level, I think we'd just stop, you know. What would be the point?
Yeah.
You know. And it's endless, isn't it? You never solve the problem. That's the thing. It's constantly trying to find solutions. And I think it keeps you young, keeps you active, keeps your brain going. But, yeah, it must be tough. I guess, though, you know, younger people coming up through college learning about industries like this, they're probably much better equipped than I certainly was. You know, I was so badly equipped. I mean, most of my career successes were, I stumbled on them.
Yeah.
You know, I seemed to be just rescued at the last moment.
Yeah.
A lot of it was not my brilliant strategizing.
You kept showing up.
It kept showing up. Kept working.
Yeah.
You know. Kept an interest, yeah. But yeah. Just, you know, things happened, and
yeah.
I wouldn't recommend that as a way of maintaining a career. But it worked for me,
yeah.
So far,
yeah.
But it must be tough. I mean, but there is quite a lot of work, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look, we're in this lovely studio, and you showed me around. There's people working, doing podcasts, and you know, there's ways of doing it.
Yeah.
You know, and in some ways, the creativity comes in. Finding creative ways to stay alive.
Yeah. It's interesting because we, you know, I think you're our 176th podcast interviewee or something like that. So, and pretty much everybody from Ireland or working in Ireland in the film industry, and we've all ages, you know, and the challenges change. You know, the challenge when, say, older people were getting into it's just getting stock, getting, you know, everything was so expensive. But if you made a film, people would see it because it was made.
Exactly.
Whereas now
it was unique.
Yeah.
It was special.
Yeah.
Yeah. Irish films especially.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. You know, I remember when I was in Rathmines, people like Cathal Black, Shea Mary Doyle, Joe Comerford, you know, these were the guys that were kind of, you know, they were the trailblazers.
Yeah.
Amazing filmmakers.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, amazing filmmakers. And God, you know, what a great legacy.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, huge kudos for achieving what they did.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, so challenging. Now, it's easy to make a film, it's harder to get it seen.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, because you're out there with so many others. And so it's difficult, different. But, you know, I think if the film has something to say, you know, that's important. I
mean,
I'm not saying it's a guarantee of anything, but it's important.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And I think the great thing about Ireland is it is small enough that, you know, I think you get a shot at some kind of exposure if you make a film. I think you get a shot at it. You know, not much more than that.
Yeah.
But I think in other places it's pretty much more difficult, you know, with bigger populations.
Yeah. Definitely. Anyway, it was great chatting to you. Good chat all day.
Lovely.
Really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been great.
Cheers. And we'll put the information for people to go see it up at the start. So we'll be encouraging everyone to go see.
Great stuff.
All right.
Thank you.
Cheers.
The woman came to Ireland from France and she fell in love with the sky. She entered it with her eyes and she gave herself willingly. She'd never seen such sorcery nor flirtation with the light. The sky would be making lavender and ochre. The sky would be purple bleeding into blue. The sky would be mixing wild colours for her and throwing them in the sea. The sky would be hinting mischief and burning it with gold. The sky would be her alchemist. She was so beautiful and alone. She could depend on it. When there was no place else to go, she could speak her sadness to it. It would be streaking secret colours only she would ever know. Another time could make her laugh suddenly with delight. She got a way of looking. The sky would roll away backwards with the wonder of her and the lowering of her eyes.
When she went away with the terrible trouble, the sky was quiet for a while. Wandering clouds this way and that, limping into blue. She would think about how it was. She would remember the silver and the grey of it, the infinity of the canyons, the primeval streaking way of it.
The sky is looking down a long empty strand, the wind-blown places she would love to go. The sky is heavy with the weight of wanting. Only the French woman and the sky would ever know.
Mm. This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.